A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Herleman, sponsored by Starburst. Starburst is a single platform to help you activate all your data, no matter where it lives. Check out our new Data Products for Dummies ebook to learn more about how your organization can utilize data products. To download your free copy, head on over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio is provided as a free community resource by Data Mesh Understanding. It is produced and hosted by me, Scott Herleman. I started this podcast as a place for practitioners to get useful information about Data Mesh, and we're at over 200 episodes. I've now left DataStax, thanks for all their help in founding things, but I've left to start Data Mesh Understanding, which is also helping practitioners to get to the information needed to do Data Mesh well. We have free implementer introduction and roundtable programs, in addition to the more advanced yet affordable offerings. So please do get in touch if you're looking for more information on how to approach Data Mesh. Just check datameshunderstanding.com for more info. There's also a helpful organization of past Data Mesh Radio episodes there if you want to dig into specific topics rather than digging through 200 different episodes. So with that, let's hit the funky intro music and listen to what you'll hear about in this interview episode. Patience and product thinking in data, building to large-scale behavior change. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Darren Wood, who's the head of data product strategy at the UK media and broadcast company ITV. To be clear, though, he was only representing his own views on the episode. Now, quick personal note, I used the phrase coalition of the willing to refer to kind of those willing to participate early in your data mesh implementation. It's an important kind of concept, but I wasn't aware of the historical context here of the actual phrase, especially when it came to being used in war, especially the Iraq War of the early 2000s. So I apologize for using that phrase, even if the concept is important to understand. So here are some key takeaways or thoughts from Darren's point of view. There's quite a few here, so strap in. Number one, overall, when thinking about moving to product thinking in data, it's as much about behavior change as action. You have to understand how humans react to change and support that. You can't expect change to happen overnight. So it's patience, persistence, and empathy that are all crucial aspects. Transformation takes time and teamwork. Number two, potentially controversial. In data mesh, it's crucial to think about flexibility and adaptability of your approach, right? Things will change. Your understanding of how you deliver value will change. Your key targets will change. Be prepared for your implementation strategy to change, or you will miss the main point of product thinking in data. Number three, when choosing your initial domains and use cases in data mesh, think about big picture benefits. You aren't looking for exact value measurement for return on investment, but you also want to target a tangible impact, such as if we do X, we think we can increase Y part of the business's revenue by Z percent or whatever, right? Get kind of specific about what is this actually going to have an impact on in the business instead of the data. Number four, Schmack defines a data product quite well in her book on Data Mesh, but data as a product is much broader. It's a much broader definition of bringing product management best practices to data. That's harder to define, but quite important to get right. Scott note here, data as a product is really hard, but it's super important. Number five, when thinking about product discovery, what do data consumers actually need producers to create? There is often a big difference between consumers' initial suggested requirements and what they actually want. And there's even a bigger difference between what they need sometimes. It's the role of data product management to bridge that gap and deliver what they need instead of what they requested. Number six, potentially controversial. there's a big difference between data product management and regular product management. In regular product management, the ability to take requirements and go away and come back with something months later works. But data is about what's happening with the business now. And those needs, you know, you have to evolve, and your what you're building evolves as your understanding of the requirements evolves. Number seven, another potentially controversial one. Similarly, in regular product management, you can kind of go away for 6 months and come back with something new and shiny, and it's great. But in data, it might take that long just to change kind of two metrics on a dashboard. And it, you know, just because it took that long to clean up the data. And at the end, you know, Darren said, no one cares. No one understands what the value was. And worse still, people are annoyed because they don't trust the new metrics. Number eight, relatedly, data products need to be even less rigid than regular products, especially regular software products, because they are a reaction to the real world as the real world is changing. You must focus on building something that flexible, that can change that much. Otherwise, you aren't going to be reflecting what matters for very long. Number nine, when building data products, get to an MVP fast. Get something in people's hands and evolve it to what they need or want. Don't try to get it perfect. When it comes to doing data products well, there's far more collaboration than most people are used to around data work. Number 10, when considering what to build, data producers need to ask consumers what question they are actually trying to answer rather than what dashboard do they want. Outcomes over outputs. It's about what you are trying to do. Scott note, and then come to an agreement on the specifics. Are you delivering the data, the insights, or the so what? I say that a lot. Number 11, potentially controversial. Data products can, and probably should, absolutely look to address multiple business questions. But when you are thinking about your MVP, focus on what is the most critical question and the minimum requirements to address that single question. You can improve the product later, but getting to first valuable insights, it is a great initial milestone to build off. Again, evolution of your product. Number 12, relatedly, maybe consider MLP instead of MVP. No, not My Little Pony, but minimum lovable product. What is the minimum you can deliver that someone will love? What are the need to haves instead of the nice to haves? What is at least one feature that users will love? And can you deliver that early to maintain engagement as you deliver more aspects of value? Number 13, actually sit with users and see how they leverage your products. That's a crucial aspect of product management. It shouldn't be any different in data. It can be a bit harder sometimes to get to specifics, but that doesn't let you off the hook. It's necessary work to do. Number 14, potentially controversial, bring as many of the folks on the data product producer team as you can into the discussions with the initial data product consumer, right? Get them in the room. That will give a more complete picture to the team. Don't treat the rest of the team as ticket takers internally with just one person, the data product manager or somebody, as the only point of contact. And you probably find and address challenges earlier when you're doing it this way, such as flagging a low quality data source if everyone is more informed. As with anything in product management, prioritization is crucial. Focus on delivering value, not simply delivering data products. Again, outcomes over outputs. Number 16, initial delivery of the data product to a consumer isn't a mark of done. It's a great place to focus on how the consumer actually uses and interacts with the data product. Get a sense of the friction points to find places to further improve your data product. No more throwing things, you know, kind of data projects, over the wall and treating them as done. Number 17, teams that understand product thinking in general are easier to teach product thinking around data. But for those teams that don't understand product thinking at all yet, you will need to spend more time with them. It can seem obvious, but each team has different educational needs to bring them to product thinking for data. Number 18, you can't try to win over everyone to something like treating data as a product yourself. You need to find your champions and advocates and then provide platforms internally for them to spread the messages of value and success. It's not only about delivering value, but showing that off a bit too, and getting others excited. Use your momentum levers. Number 19, when choosing your first domains to work with and finding your first data products for Data Mesh, look for people that are enthusiasts. You want partners early on, not someone you have to constantly convince. Also look for data products that will be reusable to find additional users to provide additional value. It's as much about building momentum as it is about delivering early value. Number 20, potentially controversial, behavior change is a crucial aspect of implementing Data Mesh. You have to understand behavior change takes time. You have to know where you will be rigid and where you can be more flexible. You say my way or the highway, most people are just going to head for the highway. You have to work out what is non-negotiable though early. That is very hard, but it's something to really think about. What are you trying to accomplish with your company's specific Data Mesh implementation? 21, relatedly, behavior change happens at different paces for different people. That will happen inside your organization too. Look to build up the critical mass, that momentum, over time so people feel like they are joining a successful movement. But you need to do your internal PR to make sure they know about those successes. Data success isn't self-evident, even though us data people often think it is. Number 22, during your transition to Data Mesh, and is it ever really done? You will have data sources that aren't part of the mesh. It will potentially be hard to integrate those with data from the mesh because your data in your data mesh has legal and governance at the core. Sources outside the mesh tend to have one-off policy approaches applied. Be prepared for some tension and consternation. Number 23, in most cases, people will inherently trust existing data sources over new data sources. That will be a challenge to your data mesh adoption, even if they objectively know the quality is better with the new source. It's human nature to trust what you already know, more, all else being equal. Involve consumers heavily in conversations about what is changing and why. Pushing change on people is likely to cause pushback. No one wants change to happen to them instead of with them. Number 24, when doing domain-driven design and data mesh, do not try to start with all your domains at once. Look to find ones that are capable enough and that you can learn from to make it easier to partner with other domains in the future. And finally, number 25, relatedly, your domain map will change. That's a part of domain-driven design. Don't try to hold on to things rigidly. Okay, enough of just me. Let's hear from our awesome guest in this interview episode. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Darren Wood here, who's the head of data product strategy at ITV. And we're going to be talking about a lot of different things, but like we're going to start a little bit with the product methodology around data products. If you've been a longtime listener, you've heard me talking so much about product thinking, you're probably sick in certain things about hearing me. So we're very excited to have somebody that isn't me that's talking about this. And how important it is, how do we actually do this in data when a lot of people aren't doing product thinking in general? So how does this even look in data? How do we think about applying this to data and data products? In general, we're going to be as well talking about behavior change, right? Darren has a background in criminology, and there's a lot of learnings from like, how do we actually influence behavior through things like infrastructure and stuff like that? Then we're going to talk a little bit about domain ownership and the domain-oriented approach to data and kind of what ITV has learned and how do we actually start to think about picking the right domains and your maturity and how you actually generate value from the start and that you don't overextend yourself. And then if we've got time, hopefully we can talk about probably my favorite topic, which is reliability engineering for data. But, you know, before we jump into that, Darren, if you don't mind giving people a bit of an introduction to yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Perfect. Sounds good. Hello, everyone. My name is Darren Wood, and I'm the head of data product strategy at ITV. As Scott said, I've got a kind of wide background, criminology, PR, marketing, product management. I've done a little bit of everything. And now kind of in the data world for the last kind of 5 years or so. So really happy to be on the podcast and talk about kind of our learnings and experience over the last few years, particularly in data mesh and building data products and domains and all those kind of good things. Looking forward to it.
And, you know, I saw Darren live at Big Data London, but if any folks want to check out his presentation as well, we'll link to that in the show notes because I think it was a really good one around what ITV has done. But let's start with the idea, you know, you just said you've done product management. So what do you think of when you hear like that data as a product, product thinking around data? How do you think about this starting to actually socialize that, starting to actually get people to think about this when, you know, even the concept of a data product, people are like, oh, I just create data products instead of data tables. And okay, now we're good, you know. How do you start to think about that conversation to get people thinking about what this actually means and where were maybe some of the roadblocks that you hit where some other people might run across?
Yeah, really good question. I think there's been a lot of discussion about this online, kind of seen more and more, and kind of the difference between a data product and treating data as a product are two very distinct things that seem to be getting a lot more blurred as time's gone on. And I think a data product in particular, like, is pretty well defined in the book. It's essentially a table or tables of data stored in something like Amazon S3 bucket or GCP, manipulated in something like Databricks or Snowflake, lots of other different ways of doing it out there, source aligned or consumer aligned, and it lies within the philosophical boundaries of a data mesh, and it's owned, loved, and managed by a team within a domain. Now, treating data as a product is bringing all of the principles of product management into data. So the way in which we look at the full life cycle from speaking to somebody who wants to an output, they want to see a dashboard, to actually delivering that is very, very key. I kind of break it down into four things. Discover, so talking to the end user, what do they actually want? A lot of the time it might come through as a ticket or something like that. You need to go out there and explore actually what that user wants, because it's often very, very different from what they stated originally. You then want to define it. So they'll ask for something. It might be data in a particular dashboard, or they might be have an end product which they're doing and they want to integrate data into it. And you've really got to translate what the user asked for and what they wanted and where those data sources are. Are they already in the mesh? Are they outside of the mesh? And then start to think about an MVP. So being in a data team, and this is one big difference between data product management and product management. In the product management world, I could go away for 6 months with a team of engineers and I'd come back with something very, very flashy. It'd be a product that could go directly out to market. In a data world, I could go and concentrate on one particular metric. It could be a subscription metric or something like that. And I could spend 6 months really working on that data quality and then come back and it's one metric. And the business over time, as we know, has got frustrated with that kind of, what are the data teams doing? So we're really kind of focusing on MVPs. How can we deliver value fast and quickly and build something over time? So if it's a dashboard, you're starting off with what metrics can we get out quickly and then build up that dashboard over time. So that's kind of the definition part. And they're developing it. So you've got data engineers rather than relying on back-end engineers. And the data engineers are kind of almost the opposite of a chef, where they're breaking down the unique ingredients of the data. Instead of, I guess previously where we've been, where we've acquired tools and we've shoved data sources into it and then hope that that tool does all the hard work, where if we break it down into the unique ingredients, data scientists can pick it up off the bat because it's gone through governance and legal. And then in the end part, we're delivering. So we're testing it, we're QAing it, we're validating it with the end user. And we're also coordinating that release. And that's quite a big difference from where data teams were a few years ago, where we're mainly working from a dashboard that might go down. Now we're integrating into end product. If those things go down, consumers are seeing it on the front line, and you've got to react quickly. So if you've built a data product, you put a new kind of metric in or a new source, and that data product then takes 2 hours extra to run. Those things are really critical because the time of which your SLAs and things like that are going out are really key. So it's really about agile thinking, trying to find an MVP, speaking to users, quick iterative processes, all that kind of good thinking from product management.
And, you know, specifically within that, I want to dig into a couple of different areas, because one thing you talked about was actually going and putting something out quickly and then iterating it and evolving it. And, you know, maybe you put something out that's quick and dirty, but people have historically not been real happy with dirty when it comes to data, because it's meant that they can't use it or that they don't trust it. So I'd love to hear about how you've evolved that. But I'd like to wrap in that just general, how are you facilitating, or how did you get your teams to a place where they can exchange information about what they need to build with their consumers? Because historically, consumers are used to requirement dumping, and then 6 months later, they get something that, one, wasn't really what they thought it would be back in that pre-6 months. And two, the world has moved so much that half the time it's not really even very valuable anymore, or it's not nearly as much of a value as it would have been because, you know, a competitor already moved on the market or something like that. So I'd love to hear how you think about getting people prepared for something that isn't quote unquote right when it comes to data, and that you're working to get them to good enough, not perfect, because that's just not helpful in data. And how do you get your teams to have meaningful conversations around what is good enough and what do they actually want instead of what did they request? Like, what's going to deliver the value? Let's not spend all of our time delivering to, you know, points, you know, 10 through 90 on the list, or 10 through 99 or 100 on the list, but like the things that actually matter.
Yeah. So the big part is facilitating that conversation. So moving beyond the Jira board or whatever it is, where that ticket comes in and says what we want out of it. Like that's where we was many years ago, and I've been on the receiving end. A ticket can come in, it can spend about 4 weeks working on it. It comes back and the person on the end can't use it. The data is not what they expected, all those things. So he's trying to stop that bit happening and trying to have that conversation as early as possible. And I think there's kind of some key questions you can ask. So things like what questions is the stakeholder actually looking to answer? So if it's an output mechanism, a dashboard, for example, what are they actually looking to answer? And then once they have that answer, what's the next step? Because usually they'll say, we're looking for this answer. It might be something goes up, something goes down. All right, now the dashboard's stuck. They come in via an analyst to ask another question. So once you've seen that thing go up and down, what's the next thing that you want to answer? Things like, how fresh does that data need to be? Everyone always says real time straight away, but they never need it to be real time more often than not. And if we take that on face value of real time, that's really painful for most data teams to try and get something in real time. Then, like going back to what we talked about, breaking down that MVP, what's the most important question that we need to answer? And that starts to get the end user to think critically about what the first thing is. Minimum expectations of what they want to answer the questions, and also the nice to haves. So straight away, then you're speaking to the end user, and ideally kind of following the Marty Kagan model of, I'd ideally like a data engineer, analyst, a delivery lead, as many people as possible to be in that conversation so they can see what that user expects firsthand, so that when the ticket comes in, eventually, they're not just looking at the detail of the ticket. They was actually there. They could see what the user wanted, and they've kind of lived it more, which brings the team, upskills them a lot more. And it also helps them to think beyond the ticket, which I think is really important. Another part is the quality expectations. So an analyst, for example, will know the source of the quality. And as I said, we can spend a lot of time kind of making that quality exceptionally good. So it might be a particular platform, like say mobile, we know from the domain perspective that we've got, let's say, 70% of that platform tagged up. And we could go on and tag up the 30%, spend another 6 to 12 months and not be able to deliver the thing. Or we could have that conversation, actually, what do you want to do out of it? And more often than not, the output is a product manager or something like that is looking for like 10, 20% shifts. So where's the value of where I can make an input as a, impact as a product manager? And so that kind of is really, really important to working out what we're going to build. But yeah, making sure that the whole team, obviously people have lots of different meetings and things like that, and some people want to get involved more than others. But I think I've always seen the biggest impact where more people from the team is involved as much as possible. And also once when you deliver the end output, for the team to actually see firsthand the frustrations that that user has using it, and the good things that are when they start to play with it, what they do. And also kind of, if it's a product example, when someone starts to develop a feature or they go into their own discovery, the team's seen that whole process kind of organic, and it really adds that buzz to the start of the process and a lot of energy.
Yeah, and I think it's part of what you were talking about there is that mindset shift of delivering to the ticket versus delivering to the customer, right? And data teams historically have been, okay, I just need to deliver to the ticket instead of deliver something that the customer can actually use. And that's that change in product thinking. How are you getting people to understand that need, right? Is it that the producing teams already kind of understand that, or like, are they understanding product thinking better than the data teams, and you're having to upskill the data people to get them to understand product thinking? Or is it everybody's kind of like, well, I delivered what they asked for, and it's like, no, you checked some boxes, not delivered a product. Like, how are you finding that kind of journey to get people to think about that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I think it really depends on the domain. So if you take a big business, there's lots of different teams within it. If your domain's aligned to a product team, most product teams now have been on that product journey. They get it. They don't quite get necessarily that it to apply it to data. So you'll still get questions of, can you just get all this stuff and shove it into this tool? And it's going through that process. Well, how you build products is the same way that we build data products and how we treat data. We want to get you something quick, off the bat, as quickly as possible, iterate and develop. But like I said, it depends on the domains that you're dealing with. So there'll be other domains that have not gone through that kind of product process and product thinking. And then you've got to go through that kind of re-education cycle of why this is the right way to do it and try and get buy-in, which is can be quite tough. You've got to find people that will work with you on it and try and find a success, and then make sure you kind of beat in the drum of getting that almost PR story out there to get more people on the journey. So trying to find the enthusiasts and the visionaries before you get to the kind of early and late majority, and then kind of, the terminology of laggards at the end of the cycle. Yeah, it really depends on the domain that you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a product domain, it's usually a lot easier. But some of the other domains can be a bit tricky. And I think, as I spoke about Big Data London, it depends as well whether you're the person in charge of your business. If they can stand at the front of your business and say, this is the way that we're going to do things from now on, that's obviously really easy for the teams then to all play into it. But more often than not, you've got to go on a cycle of buy-in and bringing people on the journey with you. And that can be a lot tougher because people kind of go on that journey at their own speed.
Yeah, and I think we're going to talk about figuring out what domains you should work with and when later as well in the conversation, because I think that's one thing a lot of people struggle with on Data Mesh is they try and go for the wrong domains for the wrong reasons as to like what, you know, you want to find your coalition of the willing at the beginning, because otherwise you're just going to be pushing and pushing and pushing instead of, you know, kind of coming together and moving forward as one unit. So I also wanted to kind of, as we're wrapping up this specific topic, talk a little bit about setting up your products to evolve. This is something that I've talked about a bit, but it's really, really difficult. Like, how do you think about that mindset shift? But also, do you have any practical like things that people can look at to actually set their data products up to evolve, because data work historically, evolution hasn't been evolution. It's been breaking change and then rebuilding.
Yeah, there's kind of three areas to this. And again, it's bringing the product thinking. So there's the natural adoption curve of kind of the product life cycle. So you start somewhere like a conversation we just had, and you're starting with enthusiasts. So these people have bought into the idea of data mesh. They get the thinking. They might be from a product background. Those are the enthusiasts. After that, it's kind of the visionaries and then the early majority and late majority after that. And I think there's a part of when you're building a data product and you're trying to go for the thin slice approach, but you're also trying to build something that's usable to more people. And there's a part of that as the curve's going up, the enthusiasts, if you stick too much on that bit, you can end up building a data product that's too specific that it can only be used by one team and not other teams. So that's kind of a call out that I noticed quite early on, that you've got to try and get over that jump quite quickly. And the kind of, again, the other curve is the kind of the intro, the data products out there, growth, maturity, then the decline of it at some point. And we're 2 years in, so you start to see that decline in some of the data products. But trying to get that growth bit is not easy, because you've got to go on, bring the business on a journey. And it's almost like you need an internal data PR team or a product marketing team, almost, that you've built a data product. All right, now, brilliant. You've put it in a data catalog. Why is nobody using it? So you may have a few people using it, but you've really got to kind of go on that whole marketing PR journey of, these are the things that we've built. This is why it's useful. These are the different use cases it can be used in. And you've got to constantly beat that drum to get it up there. And I think the final three things are kind of deciding what to do with a data product. So you can continue to evolve it, look at more use cases, apply it to other domains. You can maintain it. So you might be building other data products at this point, but you've got a data product there that still requires maintenance, and you still need to bring that, make sure it's on your kind of roadmap. Or you can choose to expire it. There might be the usage might have gone down. It might be taking a lot longer time to work with now than it previously did. Lots of different reasons. But those are the three kind of main parts, because the data products within the mesh need to be constantly usable and unique and all those good things that you'd expect, so that when someone comes to use them, it's got all the quality in there that they expect and they can use it straight away is really key.
Yeah, I think that balance of unique but not only to one use case is always a fun kind of challenge, because it's it's not what we've done in data. We've either made stuff way too broad or way too specific. And so how do we play that line in between is very tough. So, I wanted to move into the concept of behavior change, because a lot of what we're trying to do with data mesh is, yes, we have to give people prioritization. We have to change these things. You know, Scott Hawkins, your colleague, many moons ago, he was on, about 250 episodes ago or so. But he was talking about, how they went in and changed people's actual OKRs and their KPIs and things like that. So, like, when you think about behavior change and you think about the ways historically people have done behavior change well, like, what do you think are the things that we can take from that and apply it to data or especially data mesh?
Yeah, I think it's a really important topic, and kind of my background of doing criminology and social policy in particular kind of focuses on the behavior change. And I think one of the most important things is that the behavior change takes time, and you've got to be willing to for that to happen. Kind of, you've got to be pushing the agenda, but also you've got to be organic about it. And I think the important part is knowing your kind of backbone. So what is the backbone of the data mesh that you're trying to implement? And what are the negotiation parts on the sides? Because as you go into the different domains, people have different opinions. And when you're trying to get it out there, you can't be too rigid, but you need to be very, very specific about what you're willing to negotiate and what you want. You don't have to make that public, but as a team, working on it, you have to be quite clear with what that is. And I think that then will allow you to have those conversations about do we negotiate about these certain points, but be really clear that in 1-2 years later down the line, your strategy hasn't moved so far away. And I always kind of, the biggest social policy example kind of completely off dates of it, but data heavily involved was kind of the social policy of trying to stop people smoking. So that's taken something like 15 years where there's quite clear things about the background of smoking and all the research and things like that. But the behavior change over time of trying to encourage people, then bringing in laws and stuff like that. It's exactly the same in businesses of, is the CEO standing up saying, this is mandatory, this is the way we're all going to work. Are you going down the behavior change route? Who are the people that you can get enthusiastic about this? How are you, you've got that regular drumbeat, monthly, weekly things talking about success stories and bringing people on that journey. And just trying to get that critical mass over time, but knowing that not everybody's going to come on that journey super fast. And if you're doing the social behavior change part of it, you don't want to be like a bull going in and causing problems in every part of the business. You need to go through it slowly, taking baby steps, one step at a time, and setting up with the business that we're not going to be able to do this in a week, 2 weeks, a month. This is going to take time. And we've got to bring people on that kind of trajectory in that life cycle.
Yeah, I think that conversation that you're talking about as well, and you know, both sides of setting expectations of, hey, this is where we're headed. You know, yes, we've made the strategy decision that we're going to do data mesh, or yes, we've done that, but it's going to take time for that impact to actually be seen. And we can't just wave the wand and everybody switches from the old way to the new way, or we can, but that's just going to cause disruption and chaos and frustration and pushback and all of that. So do we want this to be successful or do we want this to be done today? And, you know, that I think that much of a harsh thing of, do we want this to be successful or do we want to rush it? Because if we rush it, it's just not going to be successful. That's not the way behavior change really works, or 1 out of 100 times that works versus the other times it's 50 out of 100, 60 out of 100, right? Yeah. It's still never perfect, but we have a significantly better chance. How were people feeling, you know, at ITV specifically when you were having that conversation with them of, hey, your roles, the things you're going to be doing are changing. We're giving you more work. We're giving you more responsibility. Like, is there anything specific that you did that really helped in setting that up so that it's been more successful?
Yeah, I think the hard part is if you've got existing data sources that aren't necessarily inside a mesh, that is one tough part, because within the principles of the data mesh, you've got legal and governance at the core of it. So all the things that's inside the mesh have been through all that process where sources outside of it, obviously it's been through some kind of process, but it's kind of, you need to think about it a lot more. And I guess people can think that data mesh can be harder to use in some respects because of the way in which you've done it, but it's right from the offset, because you've got those quality in place, you've got observability, it's gone through legal and governance, the stuff's ready to use, people are owning it, looking after it, managing it. And I think that's kind of really important. And kind of, I think one of the other parts I talked about was that objective data quality and trying to get that into the data products. Like, were these existing data sources, what are the data quality like in there? And when you've got it inside the data mesh, what is that like? Hopefully it's better inside the data mesh. But otherwise, if you've got two different worlds and people can go into one easier than another and use data, it can create difficulties, and you've got to have that conversation and kind of drive it forward, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I think there's some anti-patterns that I've heard in there of, you know, one good pattern is make it so that it's for the producers, not just the consumers, but of that it's so much easier for them to do their own work by putting it through the data mesh thing, you know, easier said than done, but that they'll just move more and more over there. But yeah, like an anti-pattern that I've heard multiple times is trying to replace reports directly, because, you know, somebody gave the example of, well, on this thing, it's 25.232. And this, and, you know, this new one, it's 25.237. So this new one has to be wrong because it doesn't match the old one. It's like, well, you know, maybe we're looking at it from a different approach, or, you know, all these different things. And yeah, that trust of the new is really difficult. Have you found anything that's really helped to smooth people trusting that this is better, or that this is an easier way for them?
Yeah, I think the listeners wouldn't see, but I was kind of smiling throughout as you were talking there, Scott. I think it's really important because, as you said, the existing data sources are always trusted more than new data sources, simply because that's what people use right now. And especially when a metric changes that someone finds really important for whatever reason. And it touches again on what I said about a data team could go away for 6 months, work on a metric. That metric then drops on a dashboard and people are really annoyed. In the product world, that doesn't happen because you've gone away for 6 months, produce something really flashy. So that is kind of a big difference between data product management and kind of traditional product management. And I think he's trying to get the user to understand the ask for this thing. The existing thing that they've got comes from these sources. These sources haven't got as good quality metrics because of these things. It's only 70% tagged. It's coming from this subscription data rather than this subscription data. What we want to do is spend a little bit of time getting it right to source. So it might be integrating directly with Stripe, for example, rather than coming through some kind of third party that aggregates all that himself. That's the big part about the data mesh, trying to get to the source of the data rather than kind of integrating with something that kind of brings lots of different parts of the data together and doing the thing yourself. But again, going back to that conversation, not just your data output, whatever dashboard might be down for a week and then suddenly all your numbers have changed. Like, integrating people into that conversation. This is why the data isn't good quality right now. This is what we're going to do. This is how long it's going to be down for. When it goes back up, expect this change. And I think that's a big important thing that we did, bringing in product thinking. If you was going to do something in the product world that affected an end consumer, you'd have that conversation up front. It might be an email out, a message on X or Facebook. This thing will be down for this period of time. And after this, expect this to be different. It might be a video on there or something. That's really important in the data world. Your dashboard, your output might be down. This is what we're going to change in it. The metric we expect it to go in up by 1%, down 1%, whatever it is, so that the user just doesn't see, hang on a minute, my numbers have changed, and start to panic. What have you done? We've had that conversation up front and we've been really sure, and we can show them in kind of a dev environment or something, and manipulate there to see, actually, this is the change that we expect. And we focus quite a lot on that over the last year to see, before we make that change, this is what we expect to happen. And it, when people know what they expect, when people understand what to expect, it makes kind of a big difference to someone kind of being alarmed because something changes and they didn't know about it.
Yeah, I mean, surprise and change are kind of anathema to or anathema. I can't remember which word that is, but to the human brain, right? Like, it's something that is hardwired into humans, that change and surprise are bad, right? That's the whole lizard brain thing of us. So yeah, setting those expectations really, really, I think, helps. And I think getting people involved in the process and keeping them informed, you know, when I was a recruiter, I had multiple people tell me I was the best recruiter that they'd ever worked with. And I'm like, that's terrifying, because I've been doing the job for, you know, 4 or 5 months or whatever in total. And it was simply because I was keeping them informed. I was keeping them involved and saying, hey, I haven't heard anything. I haven't, you know, just kind of that empathy angle of, that's part of, you know, Jamak, when she talks, she uses the phrase delight customers a lot. She uses it almost every probably if you listen to the Jamax Corners, she probably uses it every 5 minutes that she talks. Literally in everything she says, it's delight customers. And part of that is having them understand what they're going to be getting and that it's not just like, you know, I know on the consumer world, a lot of people like to make these big surprises and, you know, you have Apple doing these, reveals and all this stuff. You have, the history of the iPhone or the iPad or any of this stuff. But that's not the way most people don't want that in their day-to-day job. That might be something that's fun, but huge surprises aren't typically something that's a great positive when it comes to, especially to data and especially a change in data.
Yeah. I think just on that kind of one approach that we used in the product world that we brought into data is kind of going beyond the MVP. And you can call it an MLP or something, minimum lovable product. And it's from that conversation of understanding what that user wants and the nice to haves. And having that conversation, you can understand there's a researcher out there, the Kano model that people can look up. And it looks in what's the minimum things that people expect, what's the satisfaction thing, so nice to have, and what's the lovable things. People generally can't explain the lovable features. And you've really got to sit down with the end users to understand what that lovable thing might be. But within that first release, you've got to try and ideally go above and beyond the minimum that they expect, because that creates the delighting factor. They didn't expect this thing to be in it. If you can get up to that lovable stage, that's when the user's kind of really delighted with what you've delivered. And you've got to put various things together. So using the kind of product example, Netflix did it with the skip button. When the episode changes and you can skip the episode, that was speaking to lots and lots of different consumers about what's frustrating about going from episode to episode and trying to drill down into that. No one's going to say prior to that, oh, what we could really do with is a skip button. That's really about discovery, speaking to lots and lots of different users and understanding how you can bring that over to the data world. A big example I've got of that in the data world is you're integrating a piece of data into a button that a consumer's using. So a ticket's come in, looks nice and simple, you integrate it, it goes out, passes QA, everything like that. The user clicks that button and it takes 20 seconds to put a number on it. The user's really frustrated because it took 20 seconds. And until you see the user doing that and understand what the user's doing, how quick they want to do that, then that changes your data product. Right, we know that when a request comes in, the output needs to be very, very quick, because otherwise the end user is going to be really frustrated by that experience. And creating that delight is, right, now that's come back really, really fast. Actually, the user probably expected that to happen really, really quick. And if it didn't happen that quick, it's going to be a frustration feature, the same as a dashboard or anything else as well. So yeah, kind of delighting the customers is really key.
Yeah, there's a pattern that I don't know how well I like. It's been something I've heard forever ago, but in Data Mesh of kind of enforcing dog fooding. So where the only place that a domain can get their data is from their own data products. They can't get it from anywhere else. And so then you go, oh, they're going to build these into such a way that delights users because they have to use it themselves. And so I think that sitting with people, you know, I had this when I worked around Apache Cassandra forever ago, which is historically, it's gotten better, but historically was one of the most difficult pieces of technology to work with. And we brought a bunch of people in to, you know, show us how they were trying to get started with Apache Cassandra. And, you know, we learned a ton because there were so many things that we thought were just givens that weren't at all, and that you have that kind of customer empathy, but you have enough empathy, not just that you want to delight them, but where are those friction points and where are the things that prevent them from finding those lovable features, right? Like if you do implement those, where are the things that make it so that you're not, that they're not bogged down in the stuff that shouldn't, you know, like I talk about this with creating data products. There should be friction in creating data products. It should be the friction in finding what's going to be valuable. But like, how do you separate that from the things that aren't creating value? Like data modeling is good friction, right? Data modeling, you do want to take away some of it, but it's finding the right data model. It's not just copying and pasting and just throwing data out there. But when you think about templating and things like that, those are bad friction points where, and guardrails and things where you just go, how do we prevent people from doing the wrong things, but how do we make this so easy? And the same thing for kind of consumers of how do we make it easy to find the things, but how do we make it so when they find, when they discover, they're actually able to understand rather than just consume and not understand the actual data that they're touching on.
Yeah. 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 We've even done that with the eat your own dog food type thing. We've even done that with the data engineers and data analysts. So the ticket, whatever that they're working on, before they output it to the end user, get them upskilled in the product or tool that it actually is. So ITVX, for example, one of the first things when we brought the team together is to get them to kind of look across ITVX and understand, go through all the kind of different features and really understand how to use ITVX.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting how we think about getting people up to speed on how data should and can be used. It's a fun thing. So I wanted to transition into the domain ownership and domain oriented approach. Like, this is something I if there were like four questions or so that I constantly get, two of them are buy-in and how do I do my domain driven design? Like, how do I find the domain boundaries? How do I think about that? How did you start to think about what was good enough? How could we move forward? How are we setting ourselves up to evolve instead of get it perfect? And that we think about like the domain as the thing that's creating value rather than it's creating data products. And how did you think about moving that ownership into them when they historically haven't owned this?
Yeah, I think one of the first things is knowing that those domains are probably going to be limited to start with. So if you're in a big business, you're not going to be able to bring in 20 domains. Like, there's just not going to be enough money to do that straight away. So how many domains are you going to do? And which domains are you going to focus on first? And also knowing that those domains will change over time. And that's really key when you're building out your platform and your infrastructure. When, say, you start off with three domains and the idea is to get to 10, for example, but ideally you'd want 20. And realistically, that might never happen. So you start off with three and then all of a sudden another domain pops up somewhere else. How does that team transition? What happens to all those data products that you've built? Who looks after them? And I think that's really critical and to think about from the start, that kind of buoyancy and fluency of how things may adapt and change over time in kind of a big business. And I think what we did is try and look at use cases. So use cases and value. So who had when we researched it, what did people want to do with data over the next kind of 2, 3, 4, 5 years? Trying to break that down into some kind of use cases and roughly, and I mean, there's a lot of conversation about this online, roughly trying to put some kind of value to it just to have that conversation. You're not trying to create some kind of perfect mathematical formula that you're putting a pound into an account or anything like that. You're just trying to have some rough ideas, some rough sums of, if we do this use case, this thing goes up X percentage wise, we could generate this kind of revenue for the business. That kind of then generates of where the domains are, kind of where you would start. And also kind of which domains are ready to come on that journey. Like, you don't want to start with three domains and none of them actually want to do data mesh and don't care about data products and haven't gone on kind of any kind of data journey. You need some kind of balance of those things. You might have one that's really ready, kind of an enthusiast, one that might be a visionary, and one that kind of might be considered a laggard or may come on that journey a bit later on. And kind of having those kind of 3, 4, 5, whatever, on kind of working on them together, it is really important, and using those PR stories across the different ones. And as I kind of talked about in the data mesh talk, kind of real understanding what each one of those boundaries are and where it lies is key.
Yeah, I think one thing that you kind of were talking about in there that really helps. What one is the coalition of the willing, right? Don't be going against the ones where you're going to be fighting them. You're going to be dragging them the whole time. You have to find the ones that are willing, even if it's not the best use case. If you can find good use cases to those, that's great. But I think you mentioned that thing about, you know, the PR, but like telling people ahead of time that when you're successful with this, especially data producers that are producing for another domain, if they're producing for themselves, then yeah, you're going to be doing great for your own domain and we're going to still sell that story internally. But when you talk about why should you do this? Well, we're going to make you famous internally and we're going to find a value measurement mechanism that attributes the value back to you. You know, you don't get 100% of the value because people still have to do work to actually execute on this, but your contribution to the value of this will be very publicly recognized, right? We're doing this in such a way where you get some benefit from it and helping people understand that this isn't, they're just doing it to help these other domains and those domains may never help them. Because that is what we're seeing, is we're seeing some kind of selfish domains that aren't helping. But if you make it of value to them in and of itself, you know, we talked about changing the KPIs and OKRs and stuff for the teams, but as well, like your Irina Arzner from RBI talked about this on her episode where she was saying, well, if I can prove out that my data has value throughout the rest of the organization, I'm going to get more money to invest in my own data work. And who's going to be the biggest beneficiary of data work in my domain? It's going to be me. And I think that conversation doesn't happen enough because we don't talk about that in data. We don't talk about comm strategies and things like that.
Yeah, and I think we focused on, I think, at least the second 6 months, really working out what those stories were. And trying to find the value in those stories. And then even we created videos speaking to the end users of like, look, this is what happened. How was the journey? What was the value at the end of it? And then communicating that around the business. We have kind of an internal page where we put all those stories on, really kind of making sure that PR story does come across. And I think it is quite hard for people coming from a data world traditionally because that's not happened before. And I do almost think there's a future role for some kind of specialist person that does that for the data team, whose job it is. But like the product marketing people that do it for the product teams where they do the external and the internal and working with the product, there's something in that for data for me where the data teams who are winning are doing that right now. But there's probably some kind of future role in that where you're telling the stories and you're sharing those around the business, change managers, whatever you want to call it. And that's really important. I think something else you touched on there is the different domains helping one another. And I think one thing that we did is, and this is kind of quite obvious in a product world, is that kind of roadmap. You've built your roadmap, but these three domains who all have a roadmap now, put those roadmaps together. What do they look like? Often you see quite quickly when you start to say, right, this domain over here is doing this thing in 3 months. But actually, if this domain brought those forward a month, then that'd be ready for the other domain a lot quicker. And how can you negotiate on those conversations of, you want this data, actually, we're building this data product over here that'll have that data. All right, cool. Can you build this over here for us? And being willing to negotiate on those things and having kind of a regular cycle, probably monthly is what we did it, where you can have that conversation and really make it so that the domains that work together with the other domains go into those stories organically. So yeah, these two domains work together that produce this amazing output. Actually, how can we get that into a video and how can we communicate that around the business? So when you get people coming together for that monthly meeting, people organically want to work together rather than just stick within the domain. And I think that kind of uniqueness of making sure that's a conversation, because the last thing you want to see is two domains that don't speak to each other and they've built the same data product from the source. Like, that's a real anti-pattern that kind of I never want to see, but can easily happen if that conversation doesn't happen.
Yeah. I think one thing that I've heard that people have talked about, you talked about the product marketing department, but as well the communications department, just internally, their job is to tell winning stories, right, about your organization. So go and talk to them and see if they're willing to have that actually to build those things up for internal communication. But, well, I know we're a little crunched on time, so we don't get to cover my literal favorite topic of reliability engineering and data. But is there anything that we didn't cover outside of that you'd like to, or any way that you'd like to kind of wrap up the episode?
No, I think we've covered everything that we set out to do. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, same here. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that would love to follow up with you. Is there any best place to do that? Is there anything specific you'd like people talking, reaching out to you about?
Yeah, LinkedIn's the best place. So I try and post on there at least twice a week. So there's kind of lots of thinking coming out on there to have a conversation, comment on it, and kind of connect with me directly if you want to kind of one-to-one conversation about anything I've talked about today or anything that's going on in your business that might be interesting. I'm always happy to talk and help out where I can.
Awesome. Well, Darren, thank you so much for your time here today. And as well, thank you everyone out there for listening. I'd again like to thank my guest today, Darren Wood, who's the head of data product strategy at the UK media and broadcast company ITV. You can find a link to his LinkedIn and his presentation at Big Data London in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Hopefully that interview episode was really useful for you. Please do consider getting in touch with guests from the show, from these episodes. Most have said they'd really love people to reach out to them. And please, as well, if you've got a minute, rate and review the podcast somewhere. It really is honestly super helpful for other people looking into kind of data podcasts to kind of get this in front of them. Data Mesh Radio is again provided as a free community resource by Data Mesh Understanding. It's produced and hosted by me, Scott Herleman. In April of 2023, I left DataStax, who were wonderful in getting the Data Mesh community stuff started, so give them a shout for streaming and real-time AI needs. But I left to start my own industry analyst kind of information as a service firm. Our offerings are affordable, and you can do them on a one-off or a month-to-month basis. Throw it on the credit card. Don't worry about like going through purchasing and things like that. The services include lots of practitioner roundtables, one-on-one data mesh kind of planning or feedback sessions and tailored introductions to other data mesh practitioners that are focused around your topics of interest. What are you actually running into challenges with? We also have some free programs around introductions and roundtables that people can kind of check out as well. Check the show notes or just go to datameshunderstanding.com for more info or helpful resources. As always, if you have suggestions for guests or topics, please do get in touch as well. And have a wonderful rest of your day. Now let's hear that funky outro music.